The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Filmmakers and movie buffs from all over the world will flock to the Monadnock International Film Festival in Keene this weekend. MONIF, as it's known, is also a great opportunity for locals to watch original features, shorts, and documentaries, and the kind of stuff that rarely plays in small-town theaters. If you listen to Word of Mouth, you know that we appreciate documentary films, and I'll be moderating a panel at MONIF on Saturday with three filmmakers whose works explore social, ethical, and political issues. The panel is called Pushing Boundaries, Opening Doors. The Guys Next Door is the story of a gay couple living in Maine whose longtime friend Rachel acted as a surrogate twice. Here's Rachel in a clip from that film answering a question she's frequently asked. Wasn't it hard to bring two baby girls to term and give birth to them and then give them up?
I didn't feel sad about not having the baby. I felt sad about the process ending. I'd been a part of this thing that had felt really important and purposeful. And then they were going off to continue this life, and it was sort of like, okay, not much else for me right now.
Amy Geller is co-director and co-producer of the film and one of the filmmakers on the documentary panel. She followed those two families for more than 3 years and witnessed their creation of a new kind of family.
You know, I think we came with our own ideas, perhaps, from our own life experiences and our own family backgrounds, but it really blew my mind in terms of what's possible. I mean, this might sound kind of trite, but love is love no matter how the family is formed. And meeting these people and getting to spend 3 years with them, following their story, really highlighted that for me and really brought home this idea that you can create family in ways that I didn't think was possible. I learned a lot through the making of the film.
That continuity, filming over time, offers the audience and often the subjects a level of unscripted reflection. Here's Eric talking about who he and his partner, Sandro, have become as parents.
I mean, it's just shocking how traditional we've become.
You put Sandro in a wig and heels, and we are the most traditional family you can imagine. But it's just not that easy. Two men raising two girls, all the gender stuff, it becomes simultaneously very important and meaningless.
Documentary films give us a glimpse into the everyday lives and often remarkable untold stories of others. Barry Frechette directs creative at a Boston ad agency. He was captivated when he heard about Shigeaki Mori, a Japanese historian who survived the American bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th of 1945. Mr. Mori later discovered that 12 American POWs also perished in the atomic explosion and its aftermath. That story is told in Barry's film, Paper Lanterns.
You know, I work in advertising, and part of my job is to make 30-second commercials and 45-second commercials. And I figured if there's a reason it came to me. And I sat down and tried to figure out how best to tell it, and I figured it'd be kind of a short film. And 4.5 years later, it's just clocks in over 60 minutes. And it was one of those things for us. It's a World War II story, and we felt a certain pressure for all of us to make sure we try to capture everyone's stories before we lost them forever.
Mr. Mori painstakingly documented this unknown slice of history, how those 12 men came to be in Hiroshima, and he then notified their families. It all took nearly 4 decades. Director Barry Frechette follows the journey of Ralph Neal of Harrodsburg, Kentucky, and Suzanne Brissette Archinsky of Lowell, Massachusetts, as they travel to Japan to officially recognize relatives who'd gone missing. Here's a clip from the film of them reading letters sent to them by Mr. Mori.
For a long time, I've been researching about American soldiers killed by the atomic bomb. I've erected a memorial dedicated to their unfortunate death
at the former site of the local headquarters of the Japanese military police, where most of them were being detained and died, and to which I pay homage on every August 6th.
There's also a National Memorial Hall in the park, which collects photos and memories of victims and survivors.
This is my belief that names of all victims should be acknowledged equally, regardless of their nationalities.
It took a lot of time and air miles to make the film, which reveals a man of almost unfathomable humanity. Mr. Mori researched the missing men not as enemies, but as human beings who deserve to be remembered like all of the 140,000 people killed in one of the most tragic events in history, and who was driven to provide their families with the truth. It's an effort recognized by President Obama when he visited the Hiroshima Peace Memorial in 2016.
We can tell our children a different story, one that describes a common humanity. Ordinary people understand this, I think. It's like the man who sought out families of Americans killed here because he believed their loss was equal to his own.
Paper Lanterns reveals a man whose kindness is almost incomprehensible to the relatives of the POWs, something that Barry and his crew grappled with, too.
You know, Mr. Mori really was never about getting the praise. He just wanted to make these connections, and for a lot of us, it was hard to understand. It took us three trips, the third trip, really, to have him open up to us, and I think he was starting to see, after experiencing these events with the family members, you know, just what impact he's had. And he's a special person. He's a peacemaker. And you know, I think in these times, in any time really, but especially these times for me anyways, these are the type of people you want to celebrate.
The Dueling Forces of Aggression and Hope is also a theme of What Tomorrow Brings. That's a film by Beth Murphy, who will be part of the documentary panel. She will also be the recipient of this year's Jonathan Daniels Award. Beth is a Cape Cod-based filmmaker who's made independent features and features for television. For What Tomorrow Brings, she embedded herself in an all-girls school in a remote, conservative village in Afghanistan. The school was launched in 2009, and the film follows it from its beginnings to its first graduation in 2015, tracing the interconnected stories of students and teachers and village elders and parents and the school's founder, Razia Jani.
The first year, you know, when men spoke to you in these villages, when you had a meeting, they wouldn't look at you because, you know, you're talking. And you are not covered. They couldn't take it. And their heads were down because my head was way up high because I wanted to look in their eyes and say that you have to make a change. And what I see is the difference right now. I can see that these men are ready to talk to us.
After the fall of the Taliban in 2001, girls' schools opened across Afghanistan, but have been under continual threat. In 2015 alone, 213 girls' schools were closed because of bombings, fires, or poison. In a scene from the film, the school's principal, Hawa, goes through her morning routine of testing the water by drinking it, reasoning that if she dies, it's just one person, not 400 girls. Hawa's vigilance underscores the tenuousness of a girls' school in a village where fathers have never allowed their daughters to be educated. And the film provides an intimate look at the gap between those girls' ambition and tradition, which in the case of teenagers like Riala, mean being forced into marriages.
She came to school with a broken nose or broken ribs. When she would be absent from school, I would continuously call their father, and I would say, what happened to Rahila? She was beaten up by her brothers, by her uncle, by her father, because they said, this is our honor that we have committed to marry you to that 70-year-old man that the father of Rahila was going to marry his daughter, who was 16 years old.
A clip there from What Tomorrow Brings by Beth Murphy. It's just one of three films and directors featured at the Monadnock International Film Festival this weekend. Beth is the winner of this year's Jonathan Daniels Award, celebrating the fusion of artistic excellence and social awareness. I'll be interviewing her on stage after the screening and award ceremony on Saturday night at the Colonial Theater. All of these films are open to the public. You'll find a schedule and ticket information at monif.org or go to wordofmouthradio.org. It started with a multi-part podcast series from the makers of This American Life. You probably know the theme. Then after Serial came The Accused.
From The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com, I'm Amber.
Crime Town.
Welcome to Crime Town.
And S-Town. Clearly, podcast fans love a good mystery, and there has been a flurry of true crime imitators and at least one great parody, which brings us to Brian Thompson and his hilarious and weirdly addictive podcast, Whatever Happened to Pizza at McDonald's. Before we bring Brian on, he's a comedian and veteran of the Upright Citizens Brigade. Let's hear just a clip from an early episode.
Welcome to Whatever Happened to Pizza at McDonald's, a podcast where I ask the question, whatever happened to the pizza at McDonald's? A proud part of the Panoply Network. I'm your host, Brian Thompson. Let's call McDonald's and see whatever happened to their pizza.
Hello, McDonald's. This is Ashley. How can I help you?
Hi. Do you serve pizza?
No, we do not.
Do you remember when McDonald's used to serve pizza?
No, I do not.
Do you know who I could talk to get more information about when McDonald's served pizza?
You could probably go online and look that up, or you would probably have to call tomorrow during the day.
What would I look up online?
I mean, you could look up online McDonald's, when did McDonald's serve pizza? I mean, sir, I don't even know that we ever served pizza.
I believe you did. So I should go to McDonald's.com and search what happened to the pizza?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. McDonald's.com. Search. Whatever happened to the pizza? No information.
No information. So, kind of a cold case. What got you hooked on this, Brian?
You know what? I don't really know what got me hooked other than the fact that it's really fun to call people at McDonald's and ask what happened to their pizza.
I'm a little shocked Ashley didn't know.
I'm perpetually shocked that nobody knows. It seems like, I don't know when I first heard about McDonald's having pizza, but I guess it was a very long time ago when they used to have it in all the restaurants in the early 90s or possibly late 80s, although I would have been very young at that time. But ever since I heard about it, I've been kind of fascinated with it. And obviously, I'm not, you know, obsessive about it. I live my life. I move on with other things. But it's popped into my head every so often over the past several years. And one day I just decided I would call a McDonald's and ask if anybody remembered it. And surprisingly, almost nobody does.
And you recorded it. I mean, you use all of these investigative podcast tools in the toolkit. Your voicing, calling private investigators, reporters, interviews, internet browsing. Did you listen to Serial as a guide to conduct your investigation?
Not as a guide to conduct my investigation, but I did listen to Serial. I don't know if you know, but Serial is the very first podcast. Before Serial, there weren't any podcasts.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Yeah. So they invented the medium, and I had to know, what is a podcast? So I listened to Serial. The show is not specifically a parody of Serials, really. Well, in season two sort of is, but initially it was just, I liked the idea of taking a very stupid mystery that's not even really a mystery and treating it with the utmost seriousness.
Are all of the phone calls that you make and all those contacts like you made with Ashley real? None of them are staged?
Oh, yeah. None of them are staged. Well, there's one sort of midway through the first season of the show that's very obviously staged. But other than that, it's all real.
And you politely thank them for their candor, I've noticed.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I like to be polite. I mean, I think the show would not be very fun to listen to if it was me being mean to people.
True. Yes, because you are talking to real people, obviously. Why do you think, though, this genre of podcast is, I don't know, easy or kind of ripe for satire?
Well, so I love these shows, and I think that they're very good shows. But I also sort of don't understand it myself, why they're so popular. Because, you know, I also watch Dateline NBC. But I feel like there's not a ton of difference between Dateline NBC and Serial. But somehow things like Serial have this patina of prestige that other things don't. I think with a podcast, it sucks you in even more because it's such an intimate medium. It's you with headphones on or you're in your car and somebody's speaking directly into your ear. I don't remember the name. What's the name of the reporter on Dateline NBC with the really, he sort of has the very creepy voice.
I think that's just about every reporter on Dateline NBC, isn't it?
Well, if that guy was speaking directly into your ear all the time, I think you'd maybe develop an even more emotional connection with him.
Let's hear another clip. This is from episode 25, and there are 34 episodes. You're trying to speak with the president, Donald Trump, to find out what happened to the pizza at McDonald's.
Good afternoon, Mar-a-Lago. Camila speaking. How may I help you?
Hello. Is this Mar-a-Lago, a.k.a. the Winter White House?
No, sir. We're at the private club, Mar-a-Lago.
Is this the club owned by President Donald Trump?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Then this is the person I should be talking to. My name is Brian Thompson. I'm an investigative journalist, and I tried calling the Summer White House in Washington, D.C., but the comment line was shut down. I have a question for President Trump, and I was wondering if I could get in touch with him.
Yeah, we're a Mar-a-Lago. We're a private club. We don't handle anything for Mr. Trump, like the organization in Washington, so I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay. Can you answer some other questions?
You didn't get very far there, Brian.
No, I think they were stonewalling me.
Well, I honestly think this would really appeal to Donald Trump. He's often talked about his zeal for fast food.
His zeal for fast food, his staunch efforts in getting to the bottom of a mystery, say, you know, where our president was born or who's been wiretapping him. He's a man with curiosity.
Have you been able to crack the case so far and find out what happened to pizza at McDonald's?
Well, I mean, if you go through the official channels like McDonald's website, they'll tell you a couple of different stories. Most of the time they'll say it was because it took too long to make. Also, they say it was too expensive. They had to develop their own special pizza ovens. At one point, I was told that the pizza boxes couldn't fit through the drive-through windows, and it was a big inconvenience because they had to walk out the pizzas to everybody at the drive-through. But none of this makes sense to me because nowadays we have Little Caesars hot and ready. It's exactly what it sounds like. You walk into a Little Caesars, they hand a pizza right to you. I don't know why McDonald's couldn't do this. And then I went to Pomeroy, Ohio, which is home to one of the only remaining McDonald's that serves pizza, and they said it's their top-selling item. So it seems like it would be a big success. In some instances, I would not attribute conspiracy to a situation where incompetence is the more likely solution. But in this case, I'm fairly certain there's a conspiracy.
Well, so this project, this mystery that started with a one-off phone call, it sounds like it's becoming a real investigation in some ways.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I definitely am following actual leads. They're pretty ridiculous, but they're real things. For example, one of the things I'm following right now is a Pakistani black market for fast food recipes. I found out that there are basically pirate fast food places in South Asia, and they buy the recipes from a black market. So I'm looking into whether I can track down the original recipe for McDonald's pizza from the Pakistani black market. I might be assassinated.
Well, I'm glad we got to talk with you first, Brian, because this is a dangerous mission.
Me too. If you don't hear from me in 3 or 4 days, then please call the police.
Brian Thompson, he's comedian and host of Whatever Happened to the Pizza at McDonald's. We spoke to him on Skype. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In addition to investigating whatever happened to pizza at McDonald's, we are also embroiled in a new side investigation into the murder of an alleged pedophile committed at Pomroy, Ohio's Soul Motel in the year 2013. In the coming weeks, we will also get to the bottom of this heinous crime and what connection it has, if any, to Pomroy's pizza-serving McDonald's restaurant. But for now, please enjoy this holiday season with your family, friends, and loved ones. Ask them if they remember when McDonald's served pizza, and if so, follow up with this question: how did it taste?
April is National Poetry Month, a time when names like Frost and Chaucer enjoy renewed popularity and book sales. But for a ragtag grassroots group of poets in Manchester, April is the end of slam season. Slam Free or Die has been rolling for almost 12 years, and this will be its 10th showing of local poets at the National Poetry Slam. Mark Pallas and Emily Eastman are co-slam masters, and we're getting ready for the second round of semifinals last Thursday at Stark Brewing Company in Manchester. Word of Mouth producer Jimmy Gutierrez went down to check out the local talent.
Hello. Welcome, everyone, to Slam Free or Die at Stark Brewing Company. Woo! We're gonna try that again.
My name is Mark Pallas. Tonight is the 2017 Slam Free or Die National Poetry Slam Team Semifinals, Round 2.
Five more from tonight. This is a two-round slam. It's 3 minutes both rounds, and you can't repeat any poems you've used previously.
How big of a deal is Nationals?
Nationals is major. There are teams coming from all over the United States and Southern Canada. Some states have multiple teams. We are actually the only team that represents New Hampshire, but I believe this year there's going to be 86 teams. It's pretty amazing.
Do you want to do a Hanson?
We did a Hanson last week. Let's do one this week. All right. Nobody loses if poetry wins, and radical softness. One, two, three, go.
Radical softness!
It was really interesting. When we first started, we weren't called Slam Free or Die. We were just the New Hampshire Poetry Slam. And then at our first National Poetry Slam, a poet from Massachusetts who we knew was walking down the street towards us, and he went, "Oh, Slam Free or Die." And we were like, "That's perfect. We have to use that." And that became our name, and it's become sort of a big part of what we're about, because we are the only venue that represents New Hampshire at these national competitions. So we like to carry that with us and to keep in mind like who we're representing and what we bring there. But it's also, for me, it's a community. It's not just an open mic. You know, there are so many people here who have found like lifelong best friends in this room who may otherwise have never met. And there are people who have really found the ability to express themselves in a way that they had always been trying to, and they were able to work things out through their poetry and find the language to talk about issues and struggles in their life.
I have done Adopt a Block. I liked it because I was helping my country be clean. I helped pick up the litter people throw on the ground. I don't like people who litter. I wish people would stop littering. It ruins nature. I don't think those people care about our world. If I were president, I would make a law for littering. My teacher wrote, "There is one."
For Victoria Suarez, littering was a real struggle in third grade. The open mic portion of the night brings people like Victoria, who are keeping things light, with people who, on the flip, are using that time and space to open up about their deepest, darkest secrets, including depression, sexual assaults, even attempted suicides. While the staff is unpaid, the dedication alone they show is worthy of a salary. Like co-slam master Emily Eastman.
Can I ask pronoun as well?
Oh, my pronouns are they, them.
They've been working with Slam Free or Die for the last 7 years in some capacity. Better put, in every capacity, including booking talent, mentoring poets, even hooking people up with housing.
It's a lot of hats, so it's hard to encapsulate, but the people who are here doing the work, yeah, we kind of all share everything, which is beautiful also, right? Because we're all like holding each other, so.
I'm guessing you wouldn't be doing all of this, the everything that we've said, if there wasn't some sort of love, passion,
connection?
Oh. I think that I've learned so much about myself and about how to move through the world, and I continue to learn all the time through the vehicle of slam. I've always written. I've always been a writer my whole life. I didn't always write poetry, but I have always had a connection to sort of the lyricism of language, and there's an energy to somebody expressing their art on a stage that is so particular and so beautiful. And when I first discovered that as a young person, it kind of gave me the perfect avenue to start to explore myself. And I feel that being involved in Slam for Your Die is actually something that's kept me in New Hampshire, because I grew up in Manchester. I was a teen here. There's not always things to do for young people, and there's this sort of ongoing dialogue about how youth leave the state. People grow up and then they move away to somewhere else, and I want here to be the place that people want to be.
And coming up next, let's hear it for Madeline.
I'm Madeline Mayenza. I'm a 20-year-old queer poet from Manchester. The most important part about slam for me is bringing that vulnerability, regardless of the numbers, regardless of what the judges are feeling in that moment. It's bringing work that you're proud of and like bringing a message that someone in that room needs to hear.
I think my most invaluable trait is my softness, not inherited, but learned. There is something to be said about the pieces of yourself that you hand-selected, the perspectives that don't come organically to us.
Madeline was one of the night's eight semifinalists who were all competing to represent the 2017 Slam for Your Die team. After the show, they were understandably in a good mood.
I qualified to go to finals. I'm so pumped and so terrified, but it's great.
So what do you have planned for next week?
That's a good question. I plan to buzz around my apartment as much as I can and kind of like throw my hands in the air and hope that good art comes out. I'm gonna try and bring honest work. That night, I returned to the scene. Fumble vibrating fingers over the peeling paint until they reunite with the light switch, and my trauma is waiting there, closed-lipped, anticipating my next move. I snatch my voice from a storage bin and throw it at the wall. There is no room for you here, with me and all my budding joy. I need the space to rebuild what you've torn down and left at my feet. My name is on this lease. You can't take the one thing I claim to own. I am not broken. I am under construction. This is your eviction notice. Read it as urgent. Pack yourself up and go. I've got work to do.
Slam for Your Die's finalists will take the stage tonight at Stark Brewing Company. Doors open at 7 and performers start at 8, including Madeline Mayenza and Emily Eastman, both competing to represent the New Hampshire Slam team this year at the Nationals. You can find out more about tonight's event and Slam for Your Die at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm Tana French, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
And I'm Virginia Prescott with the Edgar Award-winning author of the Dublin Murder Squad series. The newest, called The Trespasser, is the sixth in the best-selling habit-forming collection. It is taken for granted, wrote Laura Miller in The New Yorker, that anyone who's read one Tana French novel will shortly have read them all. French wrote her debut novel, In the Woods, during the long stretches between parts as a stage actress in Dublin. That theatrical training, understanding people from the inside out, may well be the edge that sets her books apart from other mysteries and police procedurals. The search for the killer becomes entangled with the search for the self. Or, as Miller put it, in most crime fiction, the central mystery is who is the murderer. In French's novels, it's who is the detective. We spoke to Tana French on a slightly noisy phone line from Dublin, Ireland, her home base since 1990. I asked how much plotting and planning she does before she sits down to write.
Oh, not a lot. I'm very jealous of those writers who go in there and they've got a whole outline, they know everything that's there, because they know there's a book in there somewhere. I tend to go in with a narrator, a main character, that's the most important thing for me, and a basic premise and a basic location. And from there, I just dive in and I hope I don't hit my head on the bottom. You know, I figure it out as I go.
Well, there's almost like this family tree structure that you've created with your characters having some relation to each other on the murder squad. They come and go, they skip through the timelines. How did you develop that?
That was accidental. As I was finishing the first book and starting to think about, you know, my God, maybe someday somebody might want a second one, I was thinking, well, the standard thing in a detective series is to follow the one narrator through all the ups and downs. But I'm not so interested in that. I like taking characters and seeing them at the crucial moment in their lives, the moment where whatever they decide, it's going to define the rest of their lives. And you can't really do that if you're following one narrator through a series, because any given person isn't going to have that many of those moments in a lifetime. You can't really whip them out one every 2 years. So I realized that I was going to have to switch narrator, and I'm very interested in the way that different people can see the same world or the same events differently, depending on what their preoccupations and their priorities are. And so I really like the idea of moving from one narrator to another and giving a different perspective, not necessarily on the events of the books, but on the narrator himself or herself and on the world in which they live.
So how deeply do you go into developing a backstory for those? You know, I've spoken to writers who, you know, figure out what their favorite drink is and what kind of sneakers they wear or whatever. You know what I mean? How much do you develop their sense of the world before you write about them?
I don't really do it before I write about them. I do it as I write about them. I think it may have to do with the fact that I'm coming from an acting background. So developing character is kind of what I'm used to doing and what I train to do. But I'm used to doing it up on my feet, as it were, rather than behind the scenes. I'm used to doing it as I work. But it's all happening as part of the process rather than as a separate previous thing for me. It's an in-rehearsal thing. So I'll do it as I write. But I do end up knowing an awful lot about the character. I end up cutting large chunks from the final draft because it's bits that I needed to write, but the audience doesn't necessarily care.
How about inspiration? Is there any particular way that you summon it, or when it's not coming, what do you do?
I think that for mystery writers in particular, it takes a certain kind of mind that's usually looking for the potential mystery in everything, in the normal everyday things. In the woods I was working on an archaeological dig and there was a woods nearby and I was thinking, oh, great place for kids to play. And then instead of stopping there like a normal person, my head went, well, what if three kids ran in there to play and only one came out and he had no memory? And then what if he became a murder detective and got brought back to that woods? You know, Faithful Place came from, I saw a suitcase on an old skip outside a house that was being gutted and started thinking, oh, I wonder how it got in there and who put it there and why and how long has it been there? What's in it? Inspiration, I think, always comes from looking for the potential mystery everywhere.
How do you know when you're done? You mentioned having to throw out large chunks of character background. How do you know what to let go of and when to stop?
I'm a perfectionist. I would keep tinkering with commas forever. When to stop is when the deadline is several days past. That's when I need to stop and send it in. I think there is a point where you've taken something as far as you can on your own, where you've been so deep into this book and you've been looking at it for so long and tinkering with it for so long that you need an extra pair of eyes. You need a second pair of eyes. There's no further that you can go. You've lost perspective. And I think one of the things that's happened as I learn more about writing is that I get better at recognizing that point.
Do you share your writing?
With my husband. He is my first reader. He's got this demon eye for structure and for sloppiness. So a lot of the time, how I know to cut that big chunk of character backstory is because he gives me that look and goes, maybe you really needed that. Does the reader really need that? And he's almost always right.
Has that ever started any intercouple arguments?
No, actually, because such a high percentage of the time, he's right. He's good at the things I'm not good at, like structure is my weak point. I'm good on characterization. I'm pretty secure on that kind of stuff. But structurally, I've had to work a lot harder.
So short of having marrying a really good editor, do you have advice for people who are just starting out as writers and not finding their way?
Okay, this was the big revelation for me when I was writing in the woods, is that you can get it wrong as many times as you need to. Like, especially if this is your first book, you don't have an editor or an agent ringing you up every now and then to go, and how's it coming along? You can take as long as you need. If you write a paragraph, if you need to write it out 50 times and 49 of them are utter crap, that doesn't matter. Only if you get it once, if you get it right once, that's all you need. And for me, this was a biggie because, you know, I'm coming from theatre. You have to get it right every night because the audience isn't going to see it again. And this feeling that you have that license to mess up. It doesn't mean you're terrible. It doesn't mean the book is going to be terrible. All you need is that one time when it's right.
Was there a book or a work or something that made you think, I need to be a writer?
There were a few of them along the way. I think the first one was The Wind in the Willows. My dad read it to me when I was about six, and I still remember hearing him read the sentence. I may be getting the wording a tiny bit wrong, but it was, he had never seen a river before, that sleek, sinuous, full-bodied animal. And I just went, whoa. It had never occurred to me that words could do that, that they could be anything but literal, that they could be used in this amazing, impressionistic way to create an emotion and an impression rather than a literal understanding. And I still remember that moment all these years later, and I think that was probably where it started off, was in that realization that words can be used to do more things than I had ever realized.
Do you have a genre toolbox, do you think, to go to play with, that feels liberating or helpful to you, or is it constraining?
There's definitely a very, very solid, concrete genre toolbox with mystery in particular. But I think, for me, it's a starting point rather than a set of constraints. For more and more mystery writers now, that's true, because the standard genres, the conventions of the genre, were taken to such a high point over the decades, you know, starting with Agatha Christie and up through the kind of burst of serial killer fiction in the 90s. Everybody had polished the standard genre conventions to such a high shine that I think by the time my generation of writers started writing, you had to be experimenting with the boundaries. You had to be playing with them, seeing what they could do differently, seeing what happened if you stretched them and pushed them, and what happened if you did different things with all those tools. Those genre boundaries make a very nice foundation. They're very solid. They keep the book within a framework. Because I write long anyway, right? If I didn't have this framework of A kills B and C finds out who done it, like, I'd still be writing 300,000 words later. I'd still be writing 3 years from now. But that arc that's so solidly built in, it keeps you on track. It keeps you from being too digressive and too out of control. And it gives the book a shape. And I like that. I like that solid underlying shape. And I like seeing what I can do to play with it.
What was the worst advice you ever got about writing?
There's no concrete piece of advice that I've got about writing, but the worst pieces that I've ever seen are the absolutes. Things like, oh, never use adverbs, never have long paragraphs, never use semicolons. The fact is that long paragraphs and adverbs and semicolons, they're all tools. Everything belongs in your toolbox. It's just knowing how to use it. And the idea that you should never use one of your tools for some reason, to me, that's ridiculous. To me, that's cutting down your vocabulary as a writer for no good reason at all.
Tana French, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Tana French, author most recently of The Trespasser, the sixth in the Dublin Murder Squad series. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Jazar Poddington Bear and David Seste. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.